We're recording on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people and we acknowledge them as traditional owners. We'd also like to pay our respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
Midnight to midnight. Welcome. Screening. Welcome to midnight screening. Welcome to screening. Welcome to midnight screening. I am screaming. I am screaming. I am screaming.
Welcome to Midnight Screening, where we let you stay up past your bedtime with the movies you probably shouldn't be watching. I'm Eliza.
Here's
Noah.
Hello.
How
I'm
you doing?
Noah. I'm good. I'm back. And Anthony's with us as well.
Hello.
And Pearl's sitting nicely as well.
She sure is. She's staring at the cables again, which she had a bit of a tussle with last recording session.
That's right. What were we talking about?
Hello, Cables, my old friend.
Yeah. The evil within Pearl was keen for a nibble.
She just
those
thinks
cables.
It's a snake. Her instincts are kicking in. She's like, oh, snake, I have to kill.
Exactly. I feel like there are particular horror movies that we watch that activate a part of Pearl's brain. And I'm like, where are you right now?
What, like the themes of the film?
Or? Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm like, I think she has really good media literacy.
I feel like it's just sounds. Like if there's a particular ringing, her ears will pick up. I don't think she's grasping, not to be rude to her, but I think she's real dumb. I don't think she's grasping the themes of like body horror or...
Do you think a cat is dumber than a dog is?
Yes, apparently. Dogs are smarter than cats.
Really?
Yeah, I think they have more developed, bigger brains.
What a sign though that to me the intelligence of a cat is their independence and self-worth.
Yeah.
Because the more of a brain that a dog has, the more subservient it is.
Wow.
Whereas the cat...
Their so-called intelligence.
We're talking about this cat right now and she's asleep.
She looks so zen.
She's stoned. Like that's the way to do it. She's just hanging out.
Maybe it's that dogs are kind of grasping the, I would argue, relatively human concept of like interdependence as like a higher form of like strength in numbers and socialization.
Then partly mirroring the way that we treat each other.
Yeah. Cats do that a little
like
as
me,
well.
Like me.
Pathetic. There's like, I don't know how legit this is, but there's like this theory that cats sort of domesticated us, that like they realized that where humans were, we had stuff that rats and like rodents like to eat. So they were like, oh, it'd be handy if we're near these stupid creatures. So they sort of became adorable and cute and like, we're like, oh, won't you look after me so that then they can have our resources.
Someone's surprising to me.
How are you defining domesticated? Because like, it's not like we've got little beds on the floor that like the cats bought for us.
They're not like convenient.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I wish I could give myself a bath by licking my whole body.
And yet, I know, it looks great.
Sorry guys, I just cannot do it. I just can't. You can't expect that of me.
Trying every day, but What do you think Pearl's favorite horror kind of genre or movie would be? Cat people,
totally. I have thought before about the day when, this is so bleak, I don't think about Pearl dying all the time, I promise, but I just love her so much. And I'm like, we will have a cat tribute season at some point about cat people. Season, exactly. We'll do 12 cat-themed movies.
Oh, God.
Cats and Cats Are Revenge of Pussy Galore.
Yes! Wait, you mean cats and dogs?
Cats and dogs, yeah. That would be great, though.
Yeah.
Cats and Cats Are Revenge of Pussy Galore.
Oh, my God. Catwoman. That'd be amazing.
Catwoman.
Yeah.
Yeah, both cat peoples, which we've done before. Speaking of things we've done before, I've done one of my favorite movies on the pod before. And today I feel like, obviously it's hard to pick a favorite film ever, but like I would say whenever I think of like what your favorite movies have most consistently been, like since we were kids watching movies, one of the films we're talking about today would be at like the top of the list, right?
Yeah, it is always in my top three. When I randomly got interviewed by a Letterboxd person, The Wicker Man was in there in my top four.
I'm sorry. We will get to the brilliance of The Wicker Man, but the fact that like you, like I would be like having a shower or like brushing my teeth and be like, yeah, the Letterboxd top four. Like what would I say? Because those videos are everywhere now. And I'm randomly scrolling through Instagram one day and Eliza was interviewed by Letterboxd.
And I don't even use Letterboxd.
And you never brought it up to anyone at all. Yeah. And everyone loved your pics as well. The Romy Michelle shout
out. I got some good clout from randoms. They're like, whoa, marry that girl. I was like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Great. It was. It was a great top four.
That's so sick. I aspire to the clout of like my
people being like
family
nice.
And loved ones finding out about shit I've done through the internet. Because I'm like...
I actually love that. Like, I think we're both pretty good at being like, oh, this thing happened to me, especially because Liz, you're always writing. You're always like have new pieces out and stuff like that, that you're always like, oh, like you can check this thing out. Or I just did this interview today. The fact that it was never mentioned was like violent. That hurt.
It didn't even register to you.
It didn't register. Like, not
that's really cool. I don't know. Oh, I'm
whatever.
Sorry, it just never came up.
Whatever. What are we watching today?
Today, we are indeed watching one of my favorite movies of all time, 1973's The Wicker Man.
The Wicker Man, The Wicker Man.
You say that every single time. From Easy A, where Patricia Clarkson, they agree to all watch The Bucket List. And she goes, yay.
The Bucket List, The Bucket List.
The Bucket List.
I've actually, The Wicker Man, The Wicker Man. I keep stopping you from saying the second film as part of this twin pick, but I cannot miss this segue because I've been waiting for a casual moment on the pod to platform a thing that you told me about The Bucket List, that
yes,
this cannot be true. This is complete bullshit to me, but like I don't have any evidence to the contrary. That
the term The Bucket List, a list of stuff to do before you kick the bucket, before you die, like it wasn't in the vernacular before the movie, The Bucket List. Like the movie came up with that
movie,
term.
The Bucket List from like whatever, 2006. Also a film that like is not great, wasn't very popular, like apparently created that term that I feel like has been in everyone's life since
2006.
That cannot be true.
It doesn't predate that apparently.
That feels fake. It
has to feel like bullshit, right?
Apparently. It's like apparently the name Wendy didn't exist before Peter Pan.
I know that one, yeah.
That makes more sense. But 2006, The Bucket List was created.
It's a bit of a Mandela effect thing where people are like, no, my grandfather used that term back in the 1960s or whatever. It's like, apparently no. Apparently the screenwriters, I guess, developed this term.
I find that so interesting.
Yeah.
Friend of the pod, Molly Ward, really loves that idea of different parts of like vernacular or terminology that feel like they've always been in your life, but actually like have a bizarre origin or like come from somewhere that feels like it kind of deflates what it originally meant. Like it's so weird the things that we take for like granted as always having existed.
Language is so malleable. It's crazy.
Casual. Yeah,
ooh, I want to talk to Molly about it. And hear
I think Molly wants to do an episode on it. We'll
have
them
on. Let's do
the
Bucket List.
The Bucket List. The Bucket List. No, I don't want to watch. I don't want to watch The Bucket List. I want to watch The Wicker Man and
The Empty Man.
Woo.
So many mans.
Men.
And but beyond the titles being The Something Man, both of these belong to a horror subgenre that I would say we both have a lot of affection for.
Totally, yeah.
They're both folk horror in a way, or films about cults at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, both folk horror and equally like it's a subgenre that has very like identifiable staples, but because what's so great about it is probably more like atmosphere or mood, it's really challenging to try and, not that you set out to make something, to put an original spin on it, but like I feel like it's something that's aped a lot, but it's not always successful. And when it's successful, yeah, it's off the back of achieving tone more so than like, you know, a crazy plot twist or anything like that. Like there's such a feeling you have to capture that these movies do really well, I think.
It's also being dense in lore.
Yeah.
Like they both have to have, like the cult obviously has to have its own weird principles that freak us out and stuff. They have to have some crazy plan that we understand as the movie goes on in a sort of detective-y mystery way, which is also really delightful.
Yeah, an established world that you're only getting like a quick glimpse into. Mm-hmm. Also the great thing for any story, especially horror, which is you immediately get a lead character that is very like morally complicated off the back of like in folk horror, they're usually stepping into or glimpsing a like religion or series of beliefs that are like really confronting to an outsider, but the people practicing it are like really happy. Like their way of life clearly serves them in some way, whereas the person doing this sort of investigation is someone that, you know, is speaking to right and wrong or laws or moral goods, but they themselves are maybe not a great person. They like, it's such a good place to put a lead character.
Yeah, they tend to have that theme of like the individual versus like conformity, maybe with like a really unrecognizable majority or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it brings up sort of like the antagonist protagonist thing in an interesting way where you're like,
yeah.
Exactly. Even just subliminally, because humans are dumb mammals, you're sort of like, get with the program, join them, one of us.
Exactly.
Or maybe I'm just like fucked up.
I feel like it also speaks to a relatively, and I say this with big like inverted commas, but like east-west dichotomy and like a bit of kind of fear attached to like
come back to normalcy,
Western cultural like, imperialism and stuff normalcy? Of like the expression of the individual is like utmost and that sort of stuff. And like maybe there's an extra layer of like fear associated with like being assimilated into like
you the think group these or movies something. Have a little bit of like Red Scare, Commie Panic.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of things do, but like probably in a really mild way.
Totally.
Yeah, stuff like that's like kind of pervasive, I think.
It just aids like another style thing I would think would really influence folk horror. Again, we'll do many more folk horror things on the show because it's a genre we love. Is inside of that sort of detective idea also the very like Lovecraftian sense that you're stepping into something where
initially not meant to know.
Yeah, exactly. And that like, you know, especially if you're like a policeman or a lawman or whatever, they usually
live by a code.
Yeah. You've been given a code that says this is the law of the land. And you step into something that you're like, oh, I am a cog in the machine of this much greater code than another man can give to me. You know, like it's actually a bigger thing than that. Before we kick in, I have to ask you. So if we have the Wicker Man and the Empty Man, that's the two men. If it was Two and a Half Men, what movie reflects the half man?
Okay. So it's like their child?
In that, you can take that how you need. I don't think it's their child in Two and a Half Men. It's one of their sons.
Yeah.
So I guess who is the son of either of these movies?
This is so early, but like this would have been such a good Triplet in the Attic rendition.
Yeah.
The triplet is a half man.
It's because the half man is going to be shit, presumably. Like I would be like, to me, the bye-bye man is the horrible son of the empty man.
Honestly? You're so correct.
Right? That's the half man.
It's it fucks up everything good that Empty Man does.
Exactly.
It's the something man. It has law and stuff.
Exactly. It's like, this is what we're doing, right?
And does it
like,
have any songs in it to match Wicker Man?
Not at all. The Wicker Man is Charlie Sheen, baby. He's just doing his own thing. It's like, what are you guys are all trying to be me?
Yeah, he's wearing a fucking bowling shirt.
The Wicker Man, but the actual giant wicker statue at the end just shoved in a bowling
shirt. They should have made some nice little clothes for him. That would have been handsome.
Yeah, they should have. Damn, they didn't think of that. They also didn't know that Chuck Lorre was
would revolutionize
about
TV.
To change the industry. Yeah.
Before we go on, do you want to tell your quick Chuck Lorre, Young Sheldon
story? I actually kind of wanted to when we started talking about that
This has been such a scattered conversation. I'm so sorry.
I love it. It's great. We have lots to talk about. Yeah. When I was in LA, like at the end of my most recent trip.
Los Angeles.
That's the Angels. I like obviously the culture there, like the film culture stuff's all really exciting to me. And I'd done the Universal Studios tour before and really liked it. And I heard that the best studio tour to do after that was the Warner Brothers studio tour, just because they have the most lots and practical sets. Like that's the place where
they actually film stuff there.
And the most like other big studios will like rent out their studios as well. Paramount's really good too, but like as in the history of Paramount's great, but they just don't have as many facilities, I think.
Yeah.
So with the Warner Brothers tour, you get on the little tour bus and there's like four rows of seats. And we're at the very back of the bus. And at the very front of the bus, the tour bus driver is like, so we love to tailor this drive to your favorite Warner Brothers movies. Like, what are the kind of things that you guys want to see? Like, shout it out. and unified all at once. Every row was like, young Sheldon. And I was like, fuck. And I just went two.
You were the folk horror hero amongst the young Sheldon worshippers.
I was like, come back to God. And at like literally everywhere you would go, they'd be like, this is where Sheldon.
Meemaw gave Sheldon a talking to. Yeah. And everyone's like, oh.
And they're like, whoa. And then you're like, oh, what else has it been in? And he's like, oh, I don't know if you know, like, you know, Mildred Pierce and East of Eden were filmed here. And you're like, ah, oh my God, what the fuck? Like every studio we would go into was like Gilmore Girls, Pretty Little Liars,
yeah.
Young Sheldon, or Big Bang Theory. And then there's giant, there's like one lot that belongs to, it's like the Chuck Lorre studio. Yeah. It's like dedicated to him. And like, of course, all of the studios have just pivoted to more their TV output. But it was just funny that I had to keep asking to be like, is that the church from the Lost Boys?
Is that the cane from Citizen Kane? Yeah,
exactly. He's like, oh yeah, we rest a code on that now. Like we use that to yeah, just like decorate the space. Like hope, it was exactly like
I
that.
I hope Joan Crawford's ghost is somehow trapped on the lot and she has to watch young Sheldon. And she would be into Pretty Little Liars, I feel.
Yeah.
She'd be like, yes, get her, Aria.
I think she would, with Gilmore Girls, just see herself in every character as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was pretty funny.
That's such a terrifying, alienating experience. Like, oh, I can't imagine wild. So, like, decisively feeling like an outsider.
And it like makes that. Me so positioned to be the I'm actually guy, where I'm just yeah. being like, sorry, and anything else filmed there, every single place, because I'm like, I want to get my money's worth and see cool shit. And like, it's fucking Warner Brothers. Like all the studios had so much cool shit filmed there. It was pretty brutal. Best part was at the very end, you walk through a space where they have the actual practical sets from Chuck Lorre shows. And I can 100% confirm for you that I am way fucking taller than the half boy from Two and a Half Men.
Mm,
okay.
You're a full man.
Just know it. When he was a child, but also now as an adult, I am taller than him. It has like a measuring thing and it just was not even close. Okay.
All right. Was that something you're feeling insecure about?
No, before? No. It's just, I knew it, but now I like know it to my core. You know, I stood next to it and I was like, there's just no comparison at all.
This is so like I'm tedious not a half man. To say, but like you're very tall and often like I'll see, like hear about someone or see someone where it's like, wow, they're insanely tall and find out they're a little shorter than you. Like yeah. Vince Vaughn, I've always thought he was insanely tall, but
yeah. That's my main one.
You're taller than Abraham Lincoln?
Really?
Yes.
Well, I'm as tall as Vince Vaughn. Yeah.
Oh, as tall.
I think. I need a remeasure. I'm
I remember
sure.
giving my partner this like cursed lecture about who JoJo Siwa was. He didn't know who she was.
Oh my God. Where do you begin?
I know. We've done a few sessions, but at one point
they invented queer culture.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It's called gay pop. And I was like, and she's freakishly tall. Like she's like a fucking mutant. She's huge. And he was like, how tall is she? And we looked it up and I was like, huh, she's a little shorter than me.
Yeah, I was like, I imagine.
Poor JoJo. Like I really thought she was like, woman's basketball player.
Yeah.
But it's like, if she's anything, not that tall. I'm not huge.
You got exactly what you deserve there.
Yeah.
But that's fine. You're a great height. I think we all are.
I'm pretty tall.
Yeah, exactly. We're not as JoJo. Tall as the Wicker Man though. He's no. right up there as he should be. He's close to the God.
We must keep our appointment with the Wicker Man.
We must.
Let's talk about
in
it.
In that house, there was a man and in that man, there was a dog and in that
In the man, there was a dog.
I need to actually learn what they are because you know what they are. I don't.
Let's start the next segment and I'll try and actually remember what it is.
Okay, so I... Oh, no. Okay, great. I'm ready.
Gosh, I love movies.
Directed by Robin Hardy. It is the folk horror film.
Mm-hmm.
It's the one that everyone knows.
Yeah.
It came out in 1973. And we watched a cut last night that is not the version I've seen most times I've watched the movie.
Yeah. I liked watching it for the purposes that we've seen the film before. So yeah. we were like, you know, it was interesting to see. But I don't know about you, but I definitely was like,
there was
the
stuff
strengths
that
of the
you
film,
understand why it was cut.
I think all of it, I was like, this is too, as a lot of director's cuts are, you're like, this drives home an idea more, but like I liked more that it was a bit more subliminal or something you picked up or didn't pick up.
In the more polished edit of
it. Yeah, that director's cut sort of like, yeah, it sort of pointed you towards certain ideas a bit too much probably.
And I think it opened with a scene that is cut from the more common version or more popular version where we see our protagonist, Sergeant Neil Howie, in church. So we're seeing the kind of regular world where he even delivers a sermon and is singing the hymn that will sing again at the very end of the movie. And that is not in the typical film. We just start with his plane flying over Summer Isle as like a folk song.
And arriving, yeah.
I feel like that kind of added to it, seeing he also is engaged to be married and it's not commented on at all. And you see his fiance like in just a wordless little scene. Were you happy having that cut out of the movie? Was it worth it?
It's actually true that maybe that one belongs a little bit more. I kind of like the idea though that like the essentially just what rocks about this movie the whole way along is the idea of presenting a community and its like rituals and beliefs and putting someone in the middle of it that's like, this is not like a moral good, like this is bad. And that without the context that he himself is like devoutly religious and like seeing him take, obviously like it's a folk horror film that does that thing a lot where he'll be like, how could you do this ritual? And then they'll say to him like,
they'll be like, was Jesus not crucified on the cross?
Yeah, exactly. Like, just stuff like that where it's like you drink from a chalice wine.
And he speaks about sacrifice and blood and stuff in the church scene at the start. So it's establishing some of that stuff.
Yeah, I feel like, I'm not sure. I guess next time we watch it, I'd like to watch it as its original cut.
Yeah.
And I maybe enjoy the idea more that the less it's known to you how religious he is, the more you watch him interact with this community for the first time and you learn of his bias by comparing it to your own. Like I'm not that religious and I kind of watch him just immediately be like, you are all heathens and this is a horrible way to live. And obviously, you know, I to a degree agree with him about ways that they live, but largely you are like, if I saw a group of people, I've never seen two people in a room that happy to be there, let alone an entire town where everyone is like, we love life, we know why we're alive, we all love each other and we all support each other. And beautiful. To see this guy come in and be like, you are all disgusting.
You're just like, fucking nerd, kink shamer.
Exactly. Get out of here, you fucking loser. Yeah.
He's a cop.
He's full. And it's.
He's the most cop person
he's
ever.
The most cop person. And they literally say that. They're like, both of these films obviously have big twist reveals, I guess. We have to talk because it's so what the film is about is that like he has been brought to Summer Isle to
find a missing girl, Rowan Morrison.
Rowan Morrison has been brought there to find her. He received her picture in the mail and was specifically called to come to the island. And the reveal is she's not dead. She appears and actually she essentially is bait. She is not the one to be sacrificed to the Wicker Man. It's him. And she's like, they've used her as this lure to bring him there. And he has been specifically chosen as the person who
would willingly go there, someone who's a virgin, going by his Christian values.
And also someone who like would not, something that didn't stick out to me before that I saw a bit more this time is that like the whole experience of giving him a few days to be amongst the community is almost to test this idea that like our community is always an invitation. If you had seen the beauty of our way of life and embraced it, you would not be our sacrifice.
If you had, you know, wavered in your faith and fucked the hot girl,
yeah,
then you would not be, you know, he keeps protesting and saying like, you can't do this. It's not Christian. Like, I don't believe in this. I'm a God-fearing man. And they're like, perfect. That makes you a great fatted calf for our purposes.
Like, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like they actually are never trying to steer him in a direction. They let him present himself as the perfect ideal of a sacrifice for their belief system. This is like the best movie. It's so good.
I love it so
much. It's really so good. And just that something this clear, like structurally and in ideas can also be so weird. And not weird in a like trying to be subversive way, in a like, at every point you are shown, as we said, a community that like,
it's really seductive.
Yeah, it doesn't have especially to teach you what now, it is. Like, it just feels lived in and all their practices make complete sense, but every one of them like slaps you in the face. And that something at this level for this time, like huge horror movie of its era, can be this naturally, yeah, subversive and make such weird choices that all don't even feel like exploitative. Like, you know, there are like this, he'll wander into a field and there's just like people.
10 couples fucking on the grass.
Nude people weeping over the graves of their lost loves. Like, it's just fully the idea of stepping into a society where you are like, this is not what is normal and therefore it is lawless. And you're like, all of them are so much happier than you.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be with them, not with you.
I think part of it is that even though their customs are bizarre and really primal and they're meant to reflect like pagan rituals and stuff, they also like present as very traditionally British still. Like they're still dressed, the girls are still dressed in cute little shift dresses of the 70s and stuff. Mm. And it has a lot of cute British hallmarks of like the pharmacy, the post office, the sweet shop. But in the sweet shop, the sweets will be like March hares and like a weird little voodoo doll baby thing. And the sweet shop, one of the weird, funniest, quickest bits when the sweet shop lady, so Mae Mortensen, she is meant to be the mother of the missing girl. But when Howie's, you know, on that first day when he's going around saying, have you seen this girl? She'll be like, I don't know her. Not my daughter. This is my daughter over here. And her other daughter, Myrtle, because everyone's named after a fucking tree or plant, which is so cute. she has a cold. And so the mum is like, oh, let me just chuck a frog in your mouth real quick. Oh, there you go. Spit him out. Okay, there you go. You're all good. And it's like, oh my God, that must be some like old wives' remedy. Probably that like regular Brits did like 300 years ago or some shit. And like, as much as Howie sees himself as a traditional, normal Christian British man, these people see themselves as that as well. Not Christian, but they are also rigidly traditional, but just in a completely different way.
Totally.
That looks much nicer.
Yeah. His customs aren't like enriching his life.
He's a miserable bastard.
They're customs that allow him to feel secure in like not living, in like making choices that you are told by people are what a life is. So that means you're a good person instead of being like actually arriving as your true, possibly very deeply sexual or weird self for a group of people. I actually really like the point you made off the back of like it being, yeah, an identifiably is it Scottish? Like
it's filmed in Scotland, yeah.
Yeah, like it's a community that like has, like they don't just, you know, wear...
they're not wearing robes the whole time.
Yeah, exactly. It's like in its own way, it is just a town with a belief system. That makes me think about so many of the horror greats are the case of like taking a national identity and then going, what happens to the sentiments of that in the areas that no one goes to? Like what happens in the middle
Australia
of Australia?
Australia rocks at that.
Like Wolf Creek, that idea of like Waking what's Fry. Going on there, Texas Chainsaw in the US, like this idea of taking an identity, like, yeah, the ideals of a place and what happens when they
where
go
unchecked. Where the old ways still exist.
Yeah, and that it's so fascinating that in a more like, yeah, like Western European sense, it would be these people that aren't like savages. It's actually this idea of like very deep, like proud culture that in a way you are told to respect because that's what, you know, that's what happens back in the mainland as well, is you're all these deeply religious people that believe in a law and an order. Like it's not a lawless place, Summer Isle. It's very-
They have their own codes.
They have their own code and in their own way, they've taken it to this new
place. And they
place.
Are, like, they worship like frivolity and fun and sex and a lot of positive things. Mm. But they are serious about their ways, obviously deadly serious.
Yeah.
But like there's that scene where Howie goes to the school because he's sure that there'll be evidence of Rowan Morrison there. And he's speaking with the schoolmistress. At this point, he's seen enough kind of evidence that at one point there was a girl called Rowan Morrison on the island, and he's kind of, it's this really frustrating back and forth with the teacher where he's like, so she's dead. You're saying, telling me she's dead. Mm. And she's like, here we don't use the word. And she just mouths it, dead. Yeah. Because like, so she's serious about that. She doesn't want to speak that into the world because they believe in this form of reincarnation that I think would strike viewers as more Eastern or like not British.
Yes.
But it's really appealing. It's like, yeah, I would love to not picture my body ending and rotting and like this jolly town of people being able to live with me forever, even if I'm a fucking turn into a rabbit or
yeah, exactly. Whatever. That scene at the school also really reflects that awesome thing where like, just on in terms of like scene flow, like each scene being interesting is like the reveal points out you, it's always kind of implied that like people are lying to me, but it's so interesting. Every single scene is him interacting with someone that isn't even like, it's not even like some people are better at keeping the lie than others. As you commented, I thought it was really
last
true.
Night,
there's like a hive mind
they
sensibility.
They keep track of what he knows as they're a community all, and you don't see them all whispering to each other. Like in a lot of these, detective goes into a small town to solve a mystery. Like you'll say like, oh, the unfriendly townspeople have secrets. It's like they're friendly and they're not lying. Like they don't consider it lying.
Or that there's like one person who's like, doesn't like what's going on here and would be like, come with me. I want to show you something. Like it's literally
so united. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And every single conversation is just like, how are you all, even the children, they're all so steadfast in what to us is like, you're lying to me.
Mm.
But they just do it in a way where all of them, it's like the weight of what's been, genuinely, it's a town that like relishing in death or something isn't, they don't see it as death. So when they're talking
they're
about
of
the severity of a policeman coming and being like, there has possibly been a death, to them, they do not react like we would when someone's like, I'm asking you about a death. They are genuinely like, that question means a different, like it has different weight or like stakes to me than it does for you.
Yeah.
You know? You asked a really great question last night that I still don't know the answer to.
Mm.
But one of the really, really great important things it poses at the end to not just precisely do the like, you know, I guess the more obvious question in the film you could take from it all the way through is like, just because it is different. And now obviously there's a sacrifice in it as well. So
the village does kill him.
They are happy. Is that, you know, is this something to be stopped? Or is this, you know, because they have a different set of beliefs than you, does that not mean that they are themselves happy? But it poses the question towards the end where he says, your crops failed last year.
Killing me won't bring back your apples.
Exactly that. Do you?
Because they had a shitty harvest.
They had a shitty harvest.
Sacrifice a human.
And this is their nature of being like, we need to make a bigger sacrifice than we've done before, which also poses like, okay, it is a society that is rooted in tradition, but this actually is a big transition for them. They haven't done something at this level.
They are still kind of tied into capital.
Yeah.
Like they still need to sell those apples.
Exactly. So
I haven't seen this movie. So the previous people that they've sacrificed, are they people from the community or are they also people from outside the community?
They said this is the first time they've ever had to do it.
A human sacrifice. So previously they've sacrificed animals and it's them being like, this is the biggest offering we've had to make. So it is a community in... yeah, transition. And there's a really great moment where he poses that question to Lord Summer. Is that his name? Lord
Summerisle. Lord Summerisle. The great Christopher Lee.
And he's so brilliant. And he doesn't falter in his eyes, but you do feel that moment of being like, no, this is still a community where people rely on a leader.
He does panic a little bit.
Does he let them down or not? You don't know, you know?
It's because like, he's just like, they won't fail. Like they can't.
It's like any time you're promised something and you're like, oh my God, do people really, maybe I should change my life and do this thing. And then, you know, like there's something about the appeal of the movie that says literally these people have no problems whatsoever. And then that ending sort of puts it in flux where you're like, no, they all are also
they need the harvest to come through
into faith still. Do you think that the harvests fail the year after that?
Mm-hmm. Well... there is nothing explicitly supernatural in the movie, huh? We don't see that their magic works or anything. I just want it to succeed.
I was going to say, isn't the appeal of the film that you love them? That you want it to work?
I think he's like a dingus. but in his eyes, he is martyred. That's what someone else says to him. He's like, we've given you something that like many Christians like yearn for. It's like the most noble yes. thing. You get to die a martyr's death. So he true. Kind of gets something for his death as well. He dies a Christian, screaming, the Lord is my shepherd, like singing a hymn. And so if he dies for nothing and then the harvest doesn't work that year, I would just be so sad.
All the gods are dead then. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. I'm really glad you pointed that out. I forgot, like, I really love that idea of like...
It's sort of redemptive for him too.
Because this idea of like being a Christian in a time where to be good is to not question and just to sort of like exist in a system that you've been given.
Sexual revolution as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. That it's almost like it doesn't cost you anything in the way that you live to say you believe in what you believe in. Whereas in this community... The gods are with us right now. Like every day we exist, like the gods are on our shoulder and we exist with the weight of that. And I have given you the gift of not just like speaking to a man that died.
You believe in heaven? Why don't you go there right now?
Yeah, exactly. It's like then if you really believe in your Christianity, then you get to feel closer to your Jesus than, you know, most Christians ever will. You get to sit in his shoes. Like I have given you the gift of your religion being something that you put your life on the line for in front of your face, again, in a very like British, very sheltered way of life where it's like religion does not save you. Your religion doesn't give you solace inside of poverty or war
or pleasure.
All it gives you is like
boundaries.
Yeah.
I feel exactly. like I can see a bunch of that stuff from both sides. Like I can see what you mean about it having the potential to be redemptive for him. But at the same time, I wonder if
he's not happy about it.
Well, if it really constitutes martyrdom because it's not elective, like he's not chosen to come to this island to be sacrificed. Like he's been tricked into it and he's
He could renounce God and he doesn't. He could say, okay, whatever. I don't believe in God anymore. I'm going to fuck that girl.
Yeah.
I'm going to, you know, leave the island and not care about the missing girl. But
that is the first scene where
he's
you're
so
like
so dogged about it.
You don't feel you see his glances at like the naked women.
He's tempted.
Around, but there's one main scene where like the innkeeper's
daughter.
The innkeeper's daughter is like in the room next to him.
She's doing some kind of like bewitching dance that's sort of like hypnotizing and seducing him by banging on his walls and like
and he's fully doing all these hand gestures. Sweating buckets like
he's like humping the wall
so damn bad it's
he's
crazy.
Like I mustn't oh I'm a virgin literally it's that please don't I'm a virgin
it's so good
oh my god
it's time
to get onto the fucking songs because especially the cut we watched last night.
It's like a musical.
The Wicker Man is a musical. It's a horror, folk horror musical. And the songs are like, sometimes they're really beautiful and meditative. Again, really traditional British folk songs. Sometimes, as in the Maypole song, they are fucking unforgettable little bangers.
So I tried to do it in the intro into this movie and I just don't know the words at all.
And I think I can try and remember
I think Eliza probably knows them quite well. So you have to imagine there's like like 20 little boys at a maypole ready to do a little maypole dance and then there's a man in the middle and he's singing
leading
this.
Them in a song. And it starts with mouth organ. It's like...
Yeah.
Oh, do you mean like jaw harp?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Mouth organ is harmonica, right?
I guess.
I don't know, whatever.
Wait, I feel like...
The doing doing.
Do you want to be tested or do we try and do it? What?
Maybe you look it up and I'll give it a go.
What's it called?
The Maypole song.
Wicker Man Maypole.
So yeah,
song.
He starts, okay, in the woods there grew a tree and a fine, fine tree was he. And on that tree there was a trunk and on that trunk there was a branch and on that branch there was a nest and in that nest there was an egg and in that egg there was a bird from that bird there was a feather from that feather grew a bird and then the kids dance around the maypole and he goes on that bed there was a girl and on that girl there was a boy and from that boy there was a seed and from that seed there was a boy man. And from that man there
no
was
it was from that seed. And on that And on that woman, on that
on what? That girl, there was a boy, and from that boy, there was a seed,
and from that seed,
there was a boy, and from that boy, there was a man, and from that man, there was a grave, and from that grave, no.
Oh, you're doing so good. Okay, wait. Okay.
Is this like a how many digits of pi situation?
But it's cyclical.
All right. Okay. Here it is.
Just give me the second verse.
Okay. And on that bed, there was a girl. And on that girl, there was a man. And from that man, there was a seed. And from that seed, there was a boy. And from that boy, there was a man. And from that man, there was a grave. And from that grave, there grew a tree.
So it all comes together, you know?
So good. And it's, the movie is just full of them.
Yeah. Like, with really like surprisingly raunchy lyrics that you're like, I believe this could be some like Renaissance era, like perv song, but yeah, it sounds so melodic and pretty,
so
that
seductive.
If you weren't paying attention, you'd just be like, ah, yes, like wholesome old Isles of Britain.
Well, again, like what is throughout the whole movie so affecting is like something that to you will be like, I'm sorry, fucking what? And you're watching 20 people be like, this is essentially
a song about erections.
This is a bedtime story to me. Like it's so enriched in the culture. It's not radical to them at all. It to them is our Father who art in heaven. Like that's just so great.
I think particularly the songs that are worshipful of like femininity or fertility or whatever, like Howie is really disturbed by, he visits the churchyard and there's a woman breastfeeding her baby on a grave. And it's sort of like, that's the most like wholesome, beautiful, natural thing in the world or whatever. And it's just because it's in his context that he's upset.
And he flips out.
Yeah. And then later on,
I mean, sorry, and at the school as well. When
the girls are learning about like some mystical phallic symbol. And he's like, what are you teaching these children? Like, he's really pissed.
It's so interesting, that one of like the breastfeeding on the grave. Because it's like, it seems like it should align with his like beliefs and values in the world, but the aesthetic way superficially that those
exactly
are being presented to him are like, have themselves been codified as like amoral. And it like, it's kind of pointing out the like some of the inherent like contradictions of his belief system of like certain things are moral, but at the same time, they're not meant to be like publicized or like viewed. They're not meant to be like celebrated. You're meant to feel like guilty about them, but that's what makes them sacred.
Absolutely.
And he's like, why don't you feel guilty about this, even though this is kind of sacred?
And the only action that he takes in service of religion is repressing things. Like the only thing that his beliefs make him, like the only way that they dictate the choices he makes is shame, is like, stop that, don't do that. Yes, I believe in the idea of that, but it shouldn't look like that. Like it's never about expression. It's always about like
repression.
Repression. Yeah, totally.
So one of the other songs is these naked women jumping over a fire in some sort of fertility ritual. And they're singing like, make the baby grow, like dancing around. And he's disgusted by that as well. And it's like,
Christopher Lee has the best clap back to that bit ever. He's like, you have naked women jumping over a fire. And then Christopher Lee's like, well, they couldn't jump through with their clothes on, could they? It's so good.
Oh, he's so sassy.
Oh, it's the best.
I think the Wicker Man to me just gets more and more desirable living in the freaking hellscape of 2024. Like, not to be gauche, but like post-pandemic, post-cottage core, whatever. Like, people would pay thousands of dollars for a retreat like that, getting naked and jumping over a fire for some bullshit self-care 100%. Fertility thing.
Also, like we haven't spoken to the...
This is the fire festival they were promised.
Yes.
Literally. Oh my God, what I
would
give.
Oh my God, I would go to Wickerfest. Yeah. I would pay so much money to go to Wickerfest.
Burning Man wishes. It's what... Like we haven't spoken to the filmmaking level as well of like, it just is so... Like the textures of like... these beautiful warm colors, like the flowers everywhere, like these cozy houses and all of their like cozy little clothes. Like
the pageantry of the costumes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially
the festival.
In the last third of the movie when it's the May Day celebration and they're all wearing their old pagan sort of like outfits.
I think you spoke to it before that I'm like, the masterpieces of film are things that like they teach you, like the way you feel about them happens outside of your control through the filmmaking elements where, you know, words aren't being said. And I think this film is so like luscious and cozy that by the end of the movie, you've watched a man die and you are like, as you said before, and you are like, I hope it works. Like, I want it to work. Like, that is the film working outside of your control of it. That is the film doing that to you because you have fallen in love with this, like, you know, ethically bad place, but they're also happy.
There can be dark implications to this sort of thinking of, like, we need to return to the old ways, obviously. Another movie that made me reflect on this is Zone of Interest,
where yeah, yeah.
the hideous Nazi characters, they really idolize an old settler, which is like extremely politically charged for, you know, current times.
Of course.
Way of like, we grow our own veggies, like we wear these gorgeous little clean, wholesome outfits. Like we're living, you know, like our ancestors did in a really simple and wholesome way. But it's just endlessly seductive, I think, as like everything else we do, like my work, the way I can catch up with friends, like the way you talk to people is all driven to progress.
Mm.
It's like the characters and setting of this movie, it's so darkly seductive to me to be like, I can just regress into the past and live in this like pocket out of time.
Mm.
And the cost of it working can be hideous, killing this poor guy, this poor loser. Mm. But by the end, feeling yourself convinced into it.
It seems like there might be an added layer of like gratification that comes from the way that it exists in contrast to other like media that superficially have this like structure or setup where there is like a cult being delved into of a kind, like by an outsider. But it seems like maybe the default expectation that people have about cults, just like in that media, but also generally maybe, is that there is an element of fear that is like the kind of glue holding the existence of a given cult together. That it's
certainly
like,
in horror as well, particularly. Yeah,
that maybe like, you know, a lot of people, I guess the implication a lot of the time is that maybe a lot of people like would not be a part of a given cult after a short stint in it if they didn't fear what would happen to them or like anyone that they cared about, like if they left or, you know, something like that, like fearing repercussions. It seems like this is, a lot of this is so satisfying because it seems like the fear is just entirely absent and it's like they exist around like positive, forward thinking, progressing, if not progressive sorts of ideals. And that like it's kind of flipped that, I guess, where like typically you see the outsider come in and they feel, but also the audience feels that sense of like oppression or like danger or something like that in the community. And they have this element of sort of like, oh, you don't know what's good for you. But in this, the outsider character comes in and is like, oh, you don't know what's good for you. And the audience is like, you're so clearly wrong that it like kind of removes the stakes as a viewer. And it's kind of like quite satisfying.
I have to say, I wonder how much of this, I completely agree with you. I think that's how I feel, how it feels to watch it today. I wonder how much we're placing our modern viewpoint on it versus people seeing it at the time or the filmmakers being like, let's show this fucked up, freaky, evil witch society. And it was shocking and scary to them because watching it now, I don't watch it as a horror movie much. It's not a very scary film.
No.
The ending is thrilling and exciting and it has dread in it. But for it to be considered, it's a really well-received film and it's often ranked highly as like one of the best horror movies. And I find it hard to balance how amazing it is as a movie versus it not being anywhere near as scary as probably any of the films. Its neighbors on lists like that.
I find the horror conversation generally with stuff, you know, like our life.
You don't care about whether how scary something is.
Oh, I just mean like, I think that talking about genre is an important thing. It's just it's funny, like I feel like a very common thing in our life is being like, we love horror movies, and then, you know, people have really strong feelings about whether they can do them or not. And the more that you watch them, the less you think about, like, to me, being actually scared by something is always more,
it's like a nice bonus.
Yeah, it's like when you start watching horror, you're really scared about jump scares, and then you get desensitized to them. And then actually they start working on you again because
new ideas that scare you where you're like, whoa, I hadn't considered that.
Because I don't preface before going into it that I have to be prepared to be scared, which means I'm much more released to something
scary. That should be the tagline of the podcast, be prepared to be scared.
To be prepared to be scared. But yeah, I think it is that the fear is more that feeling of you challenging your view of things because you feel really swept away by this community. Like, if anything, in what you were just saying before, Anthony, it made me think, like, the does that end scene of him being sacrificed not pose the, like, final statement as to how a entire civilization moves towards such strict boundaries is because of an inherent value that the more intelligent and evolved we become, we should not kill each other. And there's this idea that, like, the more that you let go of every little social convention, the more you would creep towards the idea that's like, well, every animal kills, like, animals kill each other. Like, that is at some point.
Cops kill plenty of people.
Yeah, oh, fucking exactly. Like, do you not go so far back that you start to say a part of the rhythm and the cycle of life and us so radically accepting our place in things is seeing this as a death, as something that can also have value. That does, it, obviously it is the main point in the movie where you go like, well, I can't fully endorse this community that sacrifices a person, but I supported them in every thing else they do. Like, I got far enough along, you know?
I think if I met someone that, you know, a boomer or someone who had seen this movie in cinemas and was like, yeah, how creepy is that movie? Oh my God, you know, I couldn't sleep at night or something after seeing it. I would feel like, huh, like you are like a Howie with respect.
Yeah.
And I am like a freaky Gen Z millennial Summer Isle resident.
It's so funny like, that I can't
I'm
even.
I'm sorry, I am not creeped. Like, I want to be there.
It's so true that the, like, yeah, I hadn't thought enough about the idea of like, us just almost really easily agreeing and not having much conversation to the fact that
probably
I'm like
an us problem.
I met this cult on its terms immediately. Like, I was like, oh, I'm not going to do it tomorrow. I love my life. But I'm like, the idea that people would live like that, I'm like, I'm glad people are out there doing that. Yeah. Like, that's
it's how, a utopia.
Yeah, fully. This is, it's such a banger. Like, it's so, so good. Oh, every inch of it is electrifying and I love it. Yay. Let's talk about another really great film.
A scarier film.
Yeah, definitely a scarier film. Let's talk about The Empty Man.
Aren't you two forgetting something?
How about channel 27?
Blood pressure of 160 over 80. Heart rate of 88. Normal sinus at this time. Respiratory rate of 18.
Everything is going to be all right. You only have to stay inside. You only have to stay all right. Do not look outside. Do not look outside. Do not need to look outside. Look out, look out, look out, look out, look out.
The Empty Man is a 2020, again, sort of cult, sort of folky horror film written and directed by David Pryor in his very confident feature directorial debut, which is really impressive. And it's a film that has a trope that apparently was like really contested as part of it, like existing, which, you know, there's a lot of unfortunate behind the scenes stuff about how this was distributed and sort of like not really supported in its release. Cause again, it's really brilliant. Like almost instantly was the thing where it's like, this will be the sort of cult classic that everyone's always being like, you probably didn't see it when it came out. Make sure you're sharing it to people because it's so good. But we love, horror is full of cold opens. It's full of like, you know, a little introduction.
Opening kill.
An opening kill sort of thing. The Empty Man essentially opens with a short film. Like it's like a 20 minute extended opening that is so effective. And apparently he had to fight to keep it in. And I think that just reflects the entire process of making something that, again, we joked about the like Two and a Half Men, like idea of, or a lot of sort of copies of a folk horror idea and that it's a hard thing to attain. But I think that from a certain mindset, watching The Empty Man, someone could, I can see how like a board of execs, for example, would dismiss this as a copy of things when actually just like Wicker Man, it has a like atmospheric quality that so sweeps you away that something like that cold open is really essential. Yeah, I just think it's so effective, that opening bit. Do you love it as well?
I really like it. I think it's a really strange movie. The structure of it, like that starting with this 20 minutes in like the fucking Himalayas or something. Like,
yeah.
It really throws you off. And then like yeah. there's not much about Pryor's direction or maybe the script from there that is groundbreaking or stuff you've never seen before.
Mm.
But it does all feel off and intriguing and
yeah.
more complicated than it is. Like we've seen it two times now. And after the first time I was sort of like, wow, I didn't grasp everything in that movie.
I know, me too.
And then on the second I was like, it's a pretty simple film.
Oh, I was kind of the same though that like I don't know, maybe I'm dumber. I still feel like, honestly, I was like, I really want to watch it again because there's things I didn't grasp the first time. And it almost, on the other end of, you know, Wicker Man has an ideology that's like so inviting. There's something about this one that has that idea where you're just touching the surface that like certain phrases or ideas will stick. But in general, it's so oppressive that like the thing that you know about it is an emotional truth, not yeah. a fact, you know.
You so just know shit's wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I still don't quite absolutely. Understand what the cult is trying to do that much. But
yeah. yeah.
Exactly. I know they're scary. I don't want to join this cult.
It's definitely spooky. No, God, not at all. I think the cult existing is like, I know the place in the human mind and in the society that we've made for each other that people would find this cult inviting.
It's sort of meant to be Scientology a little bit.
Yeah, to a degree, yeah. It's so I should say, so the cold open is, it's 1995 in Bhutan.
Okay.
And it's these four friends that go hiking in like a snowy mountainscape, and essentially they stumble on this skeletal sort of like giant entity. It sort of reminds me of the
big old hands,
the space jockey thing from Alien. Mm. Like this sort of like human looking, but then it's like huge and in this sort of crouched position. And essentially, from the moment that this, you know, random hiker stumbles on it, creates this, like, you know, in that cold open, all of the friends feel the effect of their friend becoming completely silent, dead stare, and almost like a cult with a almost like suicide pact mentality, that once you invite in this folklore entity, the Empty Man, you embrace an ideology that says that like the whole like value system of him is really hard to pin down, but it's like there's a unity in the void, in death, in like everyone uniting around the idea that everything, we attach meaning to things to make ourselves feel safe, and that actually the only truth is nothingness, and that is where you belong.
It's almost a bit like Invasion of the Body Snatchers pod people,
like yeah.
this sinister idea of humans achieving like a singularity of consciousness. And it's like, yeah. I can see, I'm sure there's heaps of cults where they're like that. We're like, we all have one brain, or like, you know, that's the cult thing, yeah. conformity. But yeah, it's terrifying to an outsider.
Yeah. And on the horror movie conversation, it's a really scary film for that idea where
cabin in the tundra.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, fully. That opening is so spooky. And just generally though, like the thing being preached, the more you look into this monster or the ideas that it reflects, it just like Wicker Man, it doesn't feel unfamiliar, which is terrifying here. Mm. The idea that like you never know what's running through their head once they've been caught by the presence, but you kind of can imagine where they're going in their mind. So like there's a scene where you witness, so it's years later and the film becomes
this hard change to meet our actual main character.
Fully straight. Like this guy is our main character, equally
James
sort
Badgedale.
Of detective-esque idea of him trying to unravel the mystery of this
missing family friend.
Yeah. His neighbor's.
Another missing girl.
Daughter. Like, yeah, his neighbor's daughter is missing and he's going to find out what happened to her. And there is this scene where a group of friends, classic horror movie style, are like hanging out on a bridge and they tell the, you know, classic horror movie setup, sort of Bloody Mary-esque thing of, if you blow on a empty bottle, across a bottle top, sort of like that whistle sound, like five times, then you will see the empty man. And then these people essentially all go insane and
they all hang themselves under the bridge. Very Bye Bye Man, actually. Very Bye Bye Man. Kids are hanging out on the bridge.
But I think what captures the movie and like the thing it sells so well is like that oppressiveness is present among them before they do it, before they call the empty man. It's that idea of like you witness six like teenagers in, you know, the end of high school. It's Missouri, right?
It's a really unpleasant looking place.
Exactly. And just that idea that like it's not like an, you know, the supernatural thing of like our quiet, sleepy town has been invited by an evil, like the empty man and the spirit it calls is actually just like the thing within us all, which is what's so scary.
Mm. It's also like for sort of used for sort of more comic purposes in the first scene where we meet the hero guy, where like he takes a coupon to like a shitty like Arby's or Denny's kind of restaurant. And it's like for your birthday, get a free meal. And all the staff come out and sing at him while he's singing, like eating by himself. And it's like, oh, this is so sad. This is the most like strip mall depressed.
Yeah.
Like he works as a security expert, like at a security shop selling like locks and stuff to people. It's like, oh God. Like
if Wicker
Man, the only way is down.
Yeah. Yeah. If Wicker Man speaks to like the normalcy being a thing you can break free from.
Mm.
The only breaking free in this world is releasing yourself to, like, the truth isn't I can be happy if I leave society. The truth is meet the darkness that is like all that is left.
Yeah. Which and he's a haunted guy in a kind of quite, well, it's shown quite cornily. He has the classic, oh, when he's sleeping, he has flashbacks of his wife and child that he lost.
Yeah.
And I think it's validated by the rest of the movie and how it ends. But yeah, he is a tortured guy already.
Yeah, he is. It's just weird. The movie is so full. Like, it's why it was so easy to dismiss. It feels like something that is just playing, as with a lot of the folk horror things we talked about, it feels like it's playing in such familiar territory that you sort of want to dismiss it. You want to be like, you're just playing in the visual staples that we know. But it always evades that. Like it always, you know, as you said, it has the like tortured flashback lead. Mm. It has a, you know, sort of not typical, but it's a bit more of a like investigative sort of like
creeping around in the cult building,
following the rabbit hole down. But it's still always at a filmmaking level is just establishing a mood that feels so like above reducing it. It feels really like intelligent.
And the scares are really good.
There's one main sequence that just I feel like we bring up all the time that is so chilling. He is at this complex of people that follow the empty man. He's been wandering around this abandoned building, like finding secrets and stuff. And he walks through the forest and there's like
night.
It's at night. There's like a giant lake separating him and a crowd of people, like 100 people all running around a huge bonfire, completely unified. Like they are running.
They look like ants.
Yeah, like exactly. And it makes you be like, are they extras? Is that animated?
Is it CGI?
Like,
yeah.
It's terrifying. And then all at once, they stop running completely in time.
And they quietly walk over to the side of the lake, the shore.
They quietly walk over.
Like, ooh, they're getting kind of close to me. I better leave.
No, they look at him first, right? Like they're running around the bonfire and then they stop and then they look at him.
The sound is awesome of like that many people moving and stopping and stuff. It's really startling.
And he takes one step back and they take one step forward. And he takes one step back and they take one step forward. But like imagine 100 people that again,
you can't see their faces.
You can't see their
faces. Just a mass of people.
Yeah, as you said, like little ants. Like it is so terrifying and it's so effectively done.
And then he finally steps on something and makes a noise and starts running. I think there's like a comedic bit where he's like, fuck this, and like runs off.
It's
and
so
they start
good.
Sprinting after him and seeing this big group of people just mobilize and come after him is like, it's so like anxiety inducing.
Yeah, it's so, so, so good. That's just like, yeah, a horror beat level where you're like, that is fucking incredible.
It racks.
Yeah, I think I, like, how do you feel about like the, actual, I guess, the lore explanations or the dialogue explanations, like, do you feel like both, do you feel like they give more or less clarity to it? And also, do you think you want more or less clarity to it?
I don't mind. I loved it. I liked the first watch of it more probably when I was left in the dark a bit more. Yeah. I don't mind not fully understanding what the evil people want to do.
Yeah.
But I'll say on a second watch, some of the screenplay of these bits where the cult leader who is played by Stephen Root, who we always love to see, and yeah, so like random. Some of the cult members that he chats with or he's like beating up or interrogating or whatever, their dialogue can be a little tedious to me. Like sometimes when they're speaking in a way that's super abstract and mystical and they're definitely foreshadowing a lot of things that we can unpack later in the film, like it didn't hold my attention the whole time.
Yeah, totally. And I just think the strength of it is a feeling less than the moments where it tries to explain it. It almost like confuses me, even though I liked being not in the know more, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it equally has the folk horror idea that like, and very Lovecraftian of this and Wicker Man, that our lead character thinks that they are active in their choices, but actually they are a part of the process.
Like that's classic.
A part of the recipe of this ritual that's happening.
Do we talk about the ending?
I think so.
Yeah. So yeah, he's been part of it the whole time. And he finally finds this girl that he was looking for in a hospital next to the very emaciated and unconscious guy from the opening scene, right?
Yeah, the opening that you haven't thought about.
The hiker from 1995.
Almost 2 hours now. This man, the hiker that
he's
like-
He's been in a coma since then.
And that essentially caused his friends up on that mountain to like kill themselves.
Yeah.
He has just been in this sort of awake coma for decades as like a conduit of the empty man.
The empty man, which is like what? Which is like an idea, which is- like this viral evil that all the cult members want to harness or...
And that...
Just where this whole idea of like the conscious unity thing came from.
And that he, our lead character, was born weeks ago. Like he's only
They're
been...
like, remember your birthday where you had that sad shitty meal in the diner? That was literally your birthday. You didn't exist before then.
Like the first time we see him on screen, that is like he was just... created.
Your memories of your wife and child were fake, which is a relief as a viewer because you're like, that shit was corny as hell.
Yeah.
So for him to be an actual empty man, it's like, yeah, they would give you a corny backstory to make you feel like you're a real person.
So that he can be the new conduit?
I think so,
Or that he is the empty man?
I think kind of both. Like he's nothing. He's not a real person. So he's the perfect vessel for the empty man. So he'll sort of be the new leader, I guess.
All the synchronized bodies like follow him?
Maybe they're sort of drawn to him or whatever.
I feel like him being there is all a part of the ritual. Or almost this idea that like, kind of like in the Wicker Man where it's like, we could just chuck you in the sacrifice the day we meet you. But the nature of you going through this experience is to prove that you are the perfect vessel. In this movie, it's almost the idea that like, you cannot create someone with this awareness of the oblivion. You have to like have them fight against it to realize that there's no use fighting. Like he has to fight to save a life. He has to fight to restore goodness to arrive at the end and be like, now you know truly.
You never had a choice.
You actually have this blessed purpose where you are a conduit of the nothingness that is the only real thing, which is... spooky, very, very scary.
In one of the opening scenes, before the girl goes missing, she also has the most whack-ass little bowl cut indie girl bob hair ever. It's nuts. They have a conversation where she's talking about the concept of, what's it called? Semantic satiation, where when you say a word over and over and over again, it sort of loses meaning. Mm. And that's the same as like a mantra or a prayer in a way. And at the end of the film, when it's revealed she's been sticking around this whole time, much like Rowan Mortison, she says that he is the result of the whole cult sort of praying or thinking about him enough that he becomes real. Because like, what is real? It's just consensus reality of like what everyone believes to be true. And he actually like manifested as a physical guy in the world. So there is actually something supernatural going on in this movie.
Yeah.
As opposed to the Wicker Man.
But it's super powerful that like, it's not like we say he was created on his birthday. Like you don't see what the real, like the-
You don't see him pop out of a portal or anything.
No, no. It's like all very intangible in this way that, again, I think the film could at some beats lean more into is this idea that like the main truth that we attach to it that makes us uncomfortable and scared is a feeling and an emotion, not like a law necessarily. Well, that the law is there, but you don't need to be taught it from a book, I guess.
And what she specifically says is that he is a tulpa. And I wanted to ask you, do you remember another movie that has tulpas in it?
No. What, a tulpa?
A tulpa. So no idea. It's like sort of like an advanced version of an imaginary friend. And in the Jimmy Stewart movie, Harvey is a tulpa.
Oh my god!
His imagined friend that is like a 7 foot tall rabbit or whatever. In the movie at some point, he says like, oh, I've been told he's some form of a tulpa, a Nepalese idea of like an imagined person that you think about enough to the point that they are for all intents and purposes real to you.
And that's so great.
So this guy is a Harvey.
Oh, I love this
movie.
Isn't that
weird? We could have done that double feature.
That's so good. I love this movie through the context that the Jimmy empty Stewart. Man is a giant Harvey. That's so great.
I would love to see Jimmy Stewart interacting with the empty man.
Yeah. Imagine this one guy praying to the empty man.
This bottle, here, bottle top over the bridge. I can't do a fucking
Well, they're really still coming at me, aren't they? They're still walking. I hope they stop soon. That's the Jimmy Stewart I got for you.
That was so much better than mine. I don't know what I was doing.
It's one of the only ones I got. Sorry. I'm not like you.
That's not true. You got many.
What would Bjork do in this scenario?
I don't want to.
They're all approaching. They're coming towards her.
Oh, no. Let me get my gun to fight off the god members.
Pearl loved it. She's looking at you. That's great.
Look away. Look away. Oh, my God.
Never cutting that, of course. Oh, my God. Why would you be? So good. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah, that's in. So obsessed with the filmmaking in this as well.
Yeah.
The,
I feel like it can be a little generic sometimes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I feel like there's a danger at the moment with a lot of the horror filmmakers of that, like, hey, I'm in danger of it. The, like, very formal framing thing that can feel more like I wanted to do a very, like, smooth shot or transition as opposed to, like, it serving the story. But I think that it elevates the things here. I think it really indicates this feeling of, like the way it moves you in and out of scenes feels really ominous, like you are aligned with more the mood of this curse that just like is everywhere at all times. Like particular moments I love is, I just think it captures a lens of like that idea you were talking about where you can say something, you know, a million times and then it becomes tangible. There's a shot when they are on the bridge before the kids sort of summon the empty man where one of the kids is doing the parallax view thing where you hold your finger in front of your face. You know how like if you have something quite close to your eyes, your field of vision, and then you close one eye.
If you wink your eyes.
Like alternating between your eyes, it'll move like left and right. It's like a shot that reflects that. And it just speaks like a film that's about
perspective and perception.
I'm like, it's kind of unsettling but beautiful. And like, that's the movie to me.
Yeah. I just think maybe this is a mercenary sort of description, but I don't think it's an expensive looking film. It looks quite cheap to me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you think cinematography wise, it like I know we can both, you more so than me, be critical of this idea now that a lot of horror is going for this like very low light thing with small pockets of light that actually can feel sort of like boring. But I feel like in this movie, there's a lot of like dimension to everything still. Or do you think it just looks a bit cheap?
I'm not thinking so much of the nighttime or scary bits. I'm more thinking like daytime when our character, maybe it's just like the actors as well. I don't need it to all be famous people. But
I don't love all the performances here either.
Yeah, no. Some of them aren't as strong. And like, I love Tubi movies, but I do kind of feel like some parts of this look like they could be like a Tubi original or something, right, where it's just him walking around town or at the school or something. And I'm like, I think Bye Bye Man is this movie's half man. And he's as a dad, the empty man is not proud of his son and is always like, you've let me down again, boy. And the Bye Bye Man is like, daddy, come on.
Please.
Yeah, but there's some filmmaking I don't love as much, but I feel like you're always more onto that stuff with direction anyway. Like you'll appreciate.
I think I'm very aware of the horror directors with a similar sensibility and I really knows when it plays or doesn't. Mm. I think David Pryor reminds me of the director of Smile, that movie Smile.
Okay, yeah.
Where that film got, you know, was a bit more of a surprise, its quality, because story-wise, it's basic. Much more like playing the beats. But the filmmaking is like really confident, but equally has the danger of, yeah, as I said, sometimes a shot, the priority is a visual trick and then actors have to fit around it, which I myself am like really afraid of. Like I still haven't, I think it's a fine line, but I think he's a director I'm like really excited to see what he does.
Has David Pryor made anything else?
He made the best episode of Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities. He made Autopsy? The only one, Autopsy. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And everyone, yeah, it's like the main one from Cabinet of Curiosities. And that episode really feels to me like The Empty Man. It opens with this shot of stars, like the night time, it's nighttime and you're looking at the stars and it's so slowly your brain does not know how to process it, turns into water trickling down a rock face, like a black rock face.
Amazing.
And it happens so seamlessly that similarly, like that shot idea as I describe it, feels like the way the direction in Empty Man is all about perspective.
Mm.
Yeah. And yeah, the different ways you can look at the same thing or the connectedness of things that seemingly have no connection.
Very cool. Because yeah, he got so done dirty by the studio with this film.
You might know more about it than me.
I don't remember the whole story, but it was like, it was in development. I think it got filmed okay and stuff like that, but then it got cut and recut heaps of times. As you were saying, the opening sequence was really embattled or whatever between people making the movie.
Mm.
And then it didn't, I think it got a cinema release in like barely any theaters, made no money. It was the last film released just by 20th Century Fox.
Before the merger.
It got bought by Disney or whatever. And it was like only a year or like a long period afterwards that people were watching it and saying, this is special. Like this is, there's something special about this movie.
Yeah.
And the director could talk about it and be like, yeah, I'm actually really proud of how it came out, but I had to really fight for this version of it. And then it just got shitted out and made no money.
Yeah. Again, it watching it, almost the need to make people watch it makes sense to me because there feels like, even just talking about the Wicker Man with it, it feels like it's something that someone who wanted it to fail would dismiss without actually meeting it on its terms and being like, all folk horror and a lot of horror comes from familiar places and staples and stuff, but like this is a really intelligent and interesting use of those ideas that like deserves attention. Like I think it's a really great film. Yeah.
Love it. Let's hold it up against the Wicker Man.
Let's do it.
All right, folks. Which of these folk horror movies did we like more? And do I need to ask that question?
Yeah, it's a hard one. You're like, we're talking about a film,
an esteemed classic
that exists because of
the other one.
Like The Wicker Man is obviously like the pick. It's one of it's like a complete masterpiece. And I always knew it is your like one of your favorite films. This rewatch in particular made me.
Is it your fave?
No, it's not my fave. Like, it, you know, favorites comes down to taste more,
sure,
I guess.
But is it like top 10, top 20?
Maybe top 20, actually. Like, I really love it. And I think the main thing that really interested me about today's convo is, and I think that both films succeed at, is like not just the idea of learning a different way of life, but like feeling it and like existing emotionally in a set of values. And Wicker Man, it's just like an incredible feat that a film allows you almost against your will to agree with something that does confront you and does feel foreign to you, but you entirely understand it. Like that is just magic. And it's, yeah, like I can't really think of a thing that I would relate that to where like you are taught a way of life, but more so you know it and feel it because it looks fun and it looks like it, the actions of the people doing it and the world it paints you in and that location and those designs and everything about it feels like a truth. It feels real to those people, you know, like it's not about a person, again, like a townsperson saying a thing they believe. It's about like in their eyes, they look so peaceful.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. Like we spoke a bit about how great the like townspeople, like that idea that they have such a shared almost like hive mind is, but like every single performance in it is like great for making you believe them and also be unnerved by them. Like, yeah. It's just incredible.
They're like Postman Pat. They're like little claymation jolly.
Yeah, they are. Grommet. They are.
I don't want to keep yakking on about the Wicker Man solely because I meant to be comparing them too much.
Yeah.
But I think it's really telling that the Wicker Man's screenwriter, Anthony Schaefer, who you pointed out got top billing of the director, which is funny. The other movie that I've seen of his is he wrote the script for Frenzy, Hitchcock's most fucked up movie.
Yeah.
And that movie is like Britain is literally like the ninth circle of hell. It's like modern Britain is the most repulsive place filled with the most unlikable, disgusting people. Yeah. And so that would be a good double feature as well, being like the lovely old Britain and the disgusting new one full of fucking tramps and bums. So I think his...
I love that.
Yeah. Whether it's political or, I don't know, his feelings on how one should live in Britain or otherwise are real clear. And they're really seductive. They're very appealing.
And as you pointed out with like it's what it is to watch it now and how we relate to the cult and the Wicker Man now, like... what a testament to a masterpiece that like it is so timeless in that, you know, the thing that we all love about art is you watch something made like hundreds of years ago and in its own way, you're speaking about the same thing.
Mm.
And the Wicker Man is so a case of like, you are speaking to a societal sickness that preaches security in boundaries.
Fascism.
And actually, what it would be to romp naked in a field is much closer to your natural bliss than anything that we've been given and told to like is what keeps you safe. But equally, Wicker Man, The Empty Man is such a great film, and watching it again, I think its biggest success, is the same thing as The Wicker Man, which is you are left with a feeling that is really confronting but not unfamiliar. Like you just know what the seed of that darkness is, and it's really scary to see an ideology that's about like embracing that truth, which I think is also a truth. Like it's another case of being like, you may not agree with how it's being practiced, but it's not like it's not a film where it's like a spooky curse and it's just like an evil entity. It's like, it's if anything, relief inside of this nothingness. That is really scary. Like
it's a scary film. These people have like a planned, wide-spanning, dark agenda that's going to make the horrible world that our character's already in even worse and like set it on a path for the apocalypse or whatever.
Totally, yeah. And just like Wicker Man, I think if it had more that thing that I was describing I love about Wicker Man where you are shown and not told that feeling or that piece would, probably like amplify it even more. I don't think it's a film that explains itself too much, but when it does... it's weird. I almost thought that I wanted it, but it left me feeling a bit more confused. And actually, maybe it would be better if I sat in the feeling more. But it's really scary. It's super confident debut. I'm really excited to see what he does next. And yeah, and I think the filmmaking of both of them is so great. We were saying in between segments just then that like we didn't speak much to with the final sacrifice. Like it is this incredible.
We didn't talk about the Wicker Man himself.
The actual Wicker Man.
Wicker structure that how he dies in. But
yeah. And
you probably know about that already.
But it's just witnessing this incredible like giant piece of design. As you said, Liz, the final shot, you're like, how did they time that?
Yeah, it's timed with the sunset and also the Wicker Man's head burning and like bowing down to reveal the setting sun. It's like
as the credits roll.
Yes.
Like literally imagine this amber sky, the Wicker Man, like the top of it is fully engulfed in flames, and as it's descending.
You don't hear Howie screaming anymore. He's probably dead
burnt to a crisp. Yeah. And the very slow like dolly that then pauses on this setting sun as the credits roll. And like just as the credits finish, the sun descends. Mm. Just like as a, you know, a miracle film, just the sort of thing that you're like, every inch of this is like this film needed to be made. Mm. And it still packs so much power. I think we should say, so we both picked The Wicker Man.
Yes.
Love. I think we need to officially put into the universe on our insane list of projects that we would love to do. We were both saying, because again, there's like an amazing musical component to The Wicker Man that's very addictive as well, that we think some crazy madman, possibly us in some future life, should do a screening of the film with like a choir and orchestra.
Beautiful.
That performs the music.
Well, what I've always said is, that sounds great, but I've always said if I get married, I want a Wicker Man wedding.
Yeah.
I want to have a big bonfire, maybe not build the actual Wicker Man. I think that would put people off, but like, have the masks, have the procession,
yeah,
have the weird little things where they lower the swords on people and yeah, stuff.
And you like, need a maypole.
Yes. Oh, gotta have a maypole.
Eliza told me last night that she convinced a friend to have a maypole at her garden birthday party when you were like in year 8 or some shit.
I was a bit older. I'd probably seen The Wicker Man. It was like in my teens. And a friend was like, yeah, I'm gonna have like a cool 18th or something party. And I was like, oh, you should have a maypole. And like was quite annoying and pushy about it. And when she kept being like, so I was thinking of ordering this for the party. I'm like, what about the maypole though? How's that coming along? Like, just really irritating about it. And like she did it. My dear friend Jess, she had a maypole.
Yay, Jess.
It was so nice.
I'm sure it elevated the party. That's awesome.
It was a little, it's sort of like, we don't know the maypole ways. Need to watch the movie more. But trying to get
did
like,
you do the duck
adults,
and weave thing?
We did it, but it's sort of like you do it and then you're like, yay! And you look at the pole and it's wound around there and you're like, so
you did
like,
it.
Do we take it away and do it again? Or
you just needed to know a joint little folk song. But again, in a live like staging,
yeah,
like a like where the movie's playing, the choir
could
sing,
erect a big maypole and then they're dancing around it.
I just think it's there somewhere. I think someone should do it.
Yeah. Outdoor screening in like a field on grass.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Botanical garden screening. That's so good. Wow. Well, loved both these movies and relishing in their
worlds. Love cult movies. Movies about evil cults. Love folk horror. Well, I'm sure we'll do more folk horror ones.
I was going to say we have to check on our triplet in the attics here, even yes, though really we could pick so many folk horror movies because there's so much to choose from. But let's check on our cheeky triplet in the attic, some third piece of anything that could be any sort of media or random thing that acts as a great sort of either like appetizer or dessert or just whatever little addition to this double feature pairing. What's your triplet in the attic for The Wicker Man and The Empty Man?
I have one that I think you'll be like, oh, easy, of course. But I chose the very extensive, long documentary Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched by Kia LaJeunesse.
Absolutely.
This is like a 3-4 hour long documentary on the history, themes, power of folk horror. And it is absolutely exhaustive. If they're, it's built around like three main movies and they're all British. And it's sort of saying these are the main pillars of the genre. And one of them is The Wicker Man and the other ones are Witchfinder General with Vincent Price and Blood on Satan's Claw.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. So they're all around the late 60s, early 70s. But this is like a long documentary essay thesis of the genre that just leaves no stone unturned. Like, it shows off some Australian stuff, some Asian cinema. I think it might even, like you said, touch on Texas Chainsaw Massacre for a second. I have a clip from it.
Oh, cool.
And like, through every possible lens, like spirituality, sexuality, indigeneity. It is a massive piece of work. And if you have to, I think it's worth watching in chunks if you're not willing to sit down for, you know, hours on end learning about this genre without having seen much of it. It might be worth, you know, watching it until you hear of a film you want to watch. Watch that movie, come back to it.
That's always the thing with movie docs where like they're so inspiring that almost it's intimidating. Like it's part of the function of this podcast is like there are just so many things for us to watch that like I love doing deep dives and stuff.
Yeah.
Especially folk horror. It does deserve that sort of like obsessive attention to detail.
Yeah.
I love that. That's a great pick. Yeah, again, even in this episode, we mentioned things that the movies made us think of. So I had so many things to pick from. I am doing two today because they speak to different things. My first pick is a kind of forgotten gem from the 80s, early 80s, a folk horror film called Dead and Buried. We have a poster of it in this room and I just like really, really love it. It's got a screenplay written by Dan O'Bannon randomly, who wrote Alien. And Dead and Buried is a, like, it's hard to speak to without giving things away, obviously, but it is really similar to The Wicker Man in that structural idea of a person entering a town on under the guise that like they are in control or have something to find out. And actually it's a town that's very like unified in its purpose. It has a reveal that like, as all great reveals do, feels so obvious once you get to it, but really you had no idea. Like it only ever could have ended one way. And it's just such a banger. It's really one of those ones that you're like, oh, you know, underrated, very overused. There's so much stuff, you know, that doesn't get the time of day. Like it's just hard to see all the great things, but it really is worth your time if you want to check out like one horror film, like folk horror film that maybe is a bit more accessible. And I also wanted to shout out more for a specific set piece that mirrors the set piece we loved in The Empty Man. And that is the 1973 more supernatural horror film, Messiah of Evil.
Oh, you've told me to watch this so many times and I've never gotten around to it. I
love
it.
I would love to do it on the pod. Atmosphere for days. It's super fun to relish in. The main beat I want to highlight is there's a sequence where one of the characters goes to the local cinema and is watching a movie. And slowly, she's like all by herself in the cinema, and slowly townspeople start to enter to watch the movie as well. And all I will say is the things that are terrifying about that scene in The Empty Man where like there is a huge unified group of people that are moving as like one organism. It's that same idea, but like from freaking 1973, like it's so scary. It really creeps on you slowly. It makes you align with the character experiencing it so much where you're like, what would you even do in this situation? It's just, it's so good. It's such a banger.
That's such a classic like paranoid delusion of like group stalking. It's like everyone is in on this.
Exactly.
Oh, it's so
exactly
creepy.
It really, yeah, it makes my skin crawl. I love in horror anything with like groups of people. It's very scary. Amazing. Bang episode. Love that. How good. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Letterboxd, where we're going to keep you posted with all eps of the podcast and any other projects we've got coming up. Next week, we have another Patreon exclusive. As I'm sure a lot of you, if you're listening to this, have been like feeling as well, it's pretty good year for horror so far. There's been so much really exciting stuff that's actually like breaking into the like popular
kind of one of the only things making money at the moment, which is like horror always makes money. So
exactly. No, yeah, so many like sleeper hits that actually the second they arrived in marketing, especially felt really confident. So for our patrons next week, we have another iteration of Now Screaming, where we're going to be talking about some of the horror bangers of the year so far. I'm seeing bangers a lot today. Some of the great horror films of the year so far, such as Long Legs, Maxine.
In a Violent Nature.
In a Violent Nature. Trap. There's so much to talk about. Very keen for it. And if you haven't checked it out yet, our patrons hopefully enjoyed last week when we talked about the winner of the slot bucket, which was The Evil Within, a film that, not that we intended to laugh at it or anything, but actually was so interesting to talk about.
Yeah, I have to listen to hear whether it ended up, it stayed in the slot bucket or if we redeemed it from there.
If we got it out of the trough. Yeah. So that was great. And our patrons also now can vote for the next iteration of the slot bucket. And if you would like to have a say as well and become
gotta
a patron
be
of the show, got to be in it to win it. If you want to be a member of our Patreon, then you can vote for the next slot bucket and pick our cinematic punishment. Here are the three options that we currently have up. A no-budget Canadian DTV horror film shot on Super 8. B, a former architect writes, directs, edits, caters, and stars as a hacker who causes government leaders to commit suicide en masse. And our new option for the slot bucket is Adam plus Eve plus Xanadu minus talent equals...
Question mark?
This film. So if you are really...
If one of them piques your interest and you want us to watch it.
Yeah, that's right. You can...
You must subscribe.
You got to vote and put us through it.
Also, it just supports the show and we really appreciate it.
Exactly. We got so much fun stuff coming up. We literally are bursting at the seams with films we want to talk about and stuff we want to do for you. Going to start having some more guests on as well. We're really excited. So we will see you on Patreon for that one next week.
Bye. There was an app. And on that cat, there was a podcast, there was a show, and on that show, there was Pearl, and on Pearl, there was a house, and on the house, there was Pearl's shit.
A lot, mostly.
Sure.
Sorry, Pearl.
I was trying to prick the show, but then it became about Pearl is on you. Yeah, sure.